Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with, get ready for this, actor, writer, director, and musician, Josh Radner. I will never do a sitcom. Never. You hear that, universe? That's what Josh Radner said to himself after some early rejections in Los Angeles. Little did he know that a few years later, he'd star in How I Met Your Mother, one of the most successful sitcoms in the history of television. Josh learned quickly that fame isn't all it's cracked up to be, but the more successful the show got, the more unhappy he became. But as Josh says, the gift of my discontent with fame was that it punctured the illusion that a hit show would save my life, and it actually made me get very serious about what matters. Josh's course correction included writing and directing two films, Happy Thank You More Please and Liberal Arts, and starting his own band, Radner and Lee, with Australian musician Ben Lee. Oh, and he's back on television too, playing the lead in Jason Kadam's new show, Rise. Josh finds his life imitating his art in the hour-long drama series on NBC, as he now finds himself the veteran among a cast mostly made up of high school-age students, whom he mentors both on and off screen. Josh joins Off Camera to explain why every creative life requires taking risks, why mistakes are always welcome at Radner and Lee shows, and why he would make a pretty good defense attorney. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Josh.
Hey, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
You know, when I was young, the most overused word, because I was a skateboarder, I grew up in Southern California, was rad.
Is that right?
Did you get the rad nickname?
Yeah, Rad Rads, J-Rad, J.T. Rads. My middle name is Thomas.
Oh, yeah, J.T. Rads.
Yeah.
So you were automatically sort of a cool guy because...
I never got shellacked with, like, a bad nickname.
Yeah.
Yeah, until I got on How I Met Your Mother. Meant they call me the nickname of the character, but my actual name was never dragged through the mud.
Now people just shout Ted.
Or whatever. I always had... a little bit of an allergy to guys calling me Radner, because I felt like my sister was 2 years older than me, and the guys in high school would be like, what's up, Radner? You know, and it always felt like kind of like locker room.
Yeah.
I think past a certain age, first name, we should call each other by our first
names. Yes.
You know what I mean?
See, I'm a Jones, so I got all kinds of, you know.
What were your nicknames?
There was Green Eggs and Ham. There was Skinny Bones Jones, because I was super skinny and tiny, which I hated. Now I'm like, God, wouldn't it be great to just be skinny without trying anymore?
Oh, my God. Yeah, you don't want to be skinny, and then, like, you hit 35 or 40, your metabolism is like, I'm out of here.
Yeah, then the rest of your life you spend telling people you used to be skinny.
I know. I was with a friend of mine the other night from high school, and we were having dinner. He was in town. And I was like, if you live to be a certain age, like, you will sit with your good buddy from high school and talk about your slowing metabolism. Like, that is an inevitability. Years ago, I did a play with an actor who told me, he said, you'll be like 40 and you'll be in the shower and you'll look down at, you know, your back and you'll get the what the's. And I was like, what are the what the's? He's like, the extra thing on your back and you go, what the?
Yeah.
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 And I got them. But I do think that if you're living with some sense of purpose or, you know, you're upgrading yourself on some level and you get some wisdom, that offsets the what this. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yes.
it's just a trade-off. Like,
yeah.
I'm one of those people, I would not want to go back to when I was 35, 25, 15 at all.
Me neither.
And I also think it's like a double whammy for, like, people say in their 20s, who are miserable. Everyone in their 20s is miserable. But it's that's the age group that is so kind of celebrated as, like, young, sexy, you got it all going on, we're going to pay attention to you, what are you wearing, what are you... And these people they're miserable, you know?
Yes.
Like, I'm working now with kids in their 20s, and I'm like, just make it to 30.
You know,
you'll be better.
That's absolutely right.
I mean, it's weird how life is like a mixture of, like, tragedy and lightness. And, like, I find the older I'm getting, there's a sadness because there's this kind of narrowing where it's like not every possible. There's certain things you realize you're not going to do. Like,
yes.
You know what I mean? Like,
you won't play in the NBA.
I will not. Yeah. We think. We're still in talks. But then there's another aspect to it where I find I'm so much less burdened by, like, certain anxieties. I find there's a mercy in, like, I can't sleep in anymore, so I have mornings. You know, the morning's good. You can get a lot done if you get up early in the day.
Yeah, that's true. And gosh, kids just throws you right in that thing, whether
yeah,
you're ready
I'm not
for it
yet,
or not.
But yeah.
People say get a dog and then you'll see what you like you're like as parents. I said, no, just get an alarm clock. Wake yourself up at 5:30.
Yeah.
No, but you know what you talk about is a good transition into Rise, because when I think of your television life, you know, on How I Met Your Mother and in Happy Thank You More Please and in Liberal Arts, you play guys that are on the other side of that. They're still seeking, they're
yeah.
trying to figure things out. They haven't been in relationships, they haven't had kids, they're still figuring out their place. And then in this new show, Rise, which it's on now, and it's created by Jason Kadams, and it's a story about an English teacher turned drama teacher in an economically depressed town.
Yeah.
And you play Lou Mazzucchelli, who has a teenage son and a whole family, and he's on the other side of that. And,
yeah.
and I think that must be interesting to step into a part where you're not representing that, hey, life still has its full potential ahead of me,
yeah.
you know? Was that a sort of a, you had to put yourself in a different mindset?
I think there's something kind of mystical about when you get a part, at what point in your life, and why you got it. Because if a part is not yours, it's really hard. The doors are locked. You're just like, I can't get through to the
people. You may really want that part.
The gatekeepers, they won't let you in. I found being an actor is a great training in like surrender and trust. You know, you have to trust that the things that are yours will come to you, and the things that aren't, you learn to let go. It takes you a while to learn that. But I think I was tapped out on playing like the man child a
right,
little bit,
right.
like the stunted kind of thing. And the two movies I wrote, so I have no one to blame
you
but myself.
You perpetrated that.
Yeah,
myth.
I mean, with Rise, you know, having a long-term marriage in the show, three kids, I definitely felt like I had changed. Like my metabolism had slowed, not just physically, but almost psychologically and spiritually. Like I was in a different settled place. Now, Lou's an interesting character because he is settled in his life. I think he believes he's supposed to be a teacher. He's married to the right woman. He loves his kids. He's in the community. But there's this feeling that he's a bit on autopilot, and he's like the pilot. He's worried the pilot light's going to go out. And I think that's when he throws himself into the theater, and that's why it's a lifeline for him.
Yes,
you know?
Yes. And, yeah. and what people may not know about this is that this is based on a real guy, Lou Volpe,
yeah.
who there's a book called Drama High.
Yeah.
And a former student of his wrote this biography about this guy.
Yeah.
And I think everyone has heard of or knows somebody or had direct contact with somebody who saw more potential in them that either they saw in themselves or that their
yeah.
parents saw, or for some reason, you know, Lou Volpe and now the character you play is sort of this catalyst for getting people to see that they can be more. And he has that special talent. And for me, what this show is really about is awakening artistic potential.
Yeah.
So that's my long-winded way of asking if you ever had a Lou in your life.
Yeah, I didn't come from a showbiz connected family. I'm from Columbus, Ohio. You know, my dad was a trial lawyer, my mom was a teacher and then a guidance counselor, and we just didn't know anyone it wasn't like, well, call Aunt Susan and find out how to be in show business. Like, I didn't have that.
You didn't have a Rosemary Clooney.
No. It turned out I did have a really, really big producer turned out to be a second cousin, but I was already on How I Met Your Mother when I found out, so I've never asked her for a single favor. But
she called you like, I need a job.
Yeah, I need you. Yeah, can you help me? No, she's doing fine. But I really didn't know anyone in the business, so It was such a leap of faith. I mean, being in Columbus, Ohio, and I remember reading the New York Times Arts and Leisure section, just seeing the ads for Broadway plays and kind of being like, how do you get in there? Like, how do you get in that world? So I had people that just pulled me aside when I first got on stage who were like, there's something. I think they saw me come alive.
Right.
After I played the MC in Cabaret, which was the second, you know, play I had ever done.
When you were in high school?
When I was in high school,
okay.
My junior year. There was a guidance counselor, Donna Oreski, who just came up to me after the show, and she said, you're to come see me first thing Monday morning in my office. And
I did. Were like, they found the drugs.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. She didn't even say good job. She just said first thing Monday morning. So I went, and she just said, you are never to stop acting.
Really?
She said, even if you become a lawyer, you have to do community theater. And she made me promise her, which I did. But I also started to feel, oh, I don't want to ever stop doing this. And I had no idea how to tell my parents. It felt like telling them, I don't know, I'm leaving for the Air Force tomorrow, or whatever, just some destabilizing familial event. Yeah.
So did they have some expectation that you'd follow an academic course of life?
I think they did. I think they had it wasn't what people from my town did.
Right.
No one did that. I don't think my parents had any sense of what it takes to be in, and nor did they know beyond talent if I had the stomach for it, which is a whole other level. You know, it's not just, I've seen a lot of talented people leave the business.
Yeah.
Because they kind of don't have the grit or something.
What was the first musical you did?
Oklahoma.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, Will Parker.
That was my one and only musical.
Really? What'd you play?
I was in the chorus.
Okay.
So right there, it's a little...
I gotta go.
Yeah. So what got you over to the theater?
It was like a weird accident. My friend Debbie Schell wanted to audition for the chorus, and she asked me to keep her company because she was nervous. So I walked down to the auditorium, and I'm sitting with her, and I'm... You know, you're watching everyone's audition. And for whatever reason, I was like, these guys aren't that good. You know,
really?
I was really arrogant. I was like, that's not going to cut it. And then they just pointed to me and said, are you going to audition? And the next thing I knew, I was up there auditioning, got a call back. You know, by the end of the week, I had Will Parker.
Wow.
So it was kind of like this weird accident. And then I knew I loved it kind of immediately. I felt comfortable with the theater kids.
Yeah.
Like I felt like I could be great at this if I worked. I was really good at a lot of things, but this was the first thing that, I don't know, it brought something out in me, and that's what prompted Mrs. Oreski and a couple of others to say, you gotta keep doing this.
And at this point, do your parents know you wanna do this? And
they do. I had to have a talk with them that I said, I wanna do a lot of theater in college. That was the talk. And my dad said, no conservatory program, no BFA, like you're not gonna go and just learn theater for 4 years. He said, you're gonna go to a proper liberal arts college, you're gonna get an education, and you can do as many plays as you want. I think they were thinking that, they were humoring me a little bit, like this will just be a thing for him to do. And then I just kept doing it. I ended up declaring a drama major. I went to a bunch of summer programs. I did a lot of like summer theater. And I always got really well cast against, you know, the East Coast kids that my dad was hoping would crush me, and they didn't.
That's terrible.
He was really hoping that I would go. You know, I went to this apprentice program at Vassar at New York Stage and Film, which is a theater I still work with. And they were doing these Shakespeare plays, and there were 60 other acting apprentices, and they were doing two Shakespeare plays. And I remember I was at a payphone, and I called my parents, and I was like, I got cast as Macbeth. And I could hear my dad's heart break, like, oh God, this is going to keep going. And they flew out to see it. And I think they were always really impressed with me on stage. It's just, it wasn't their world, you know?
Right.
My dad revealed to me years later how terrified he was and how he kept it from me.
What was he scared of?
He was scared of him supporting me his whole life, you know, that I wouldn't be able to do this on my own, or that I would be... I wouldn't be able to, I don't know, support a family, or that I'd be homeless. Was, you know, kind of the crazy one.
Right.
But I think
But dads do that, don't they?
Zero
they
to 60.
They extrapolate out.
They're worst case scenario thinkers.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think he was just worried that I wouldn't be able to string it together. But again, I don't think he had any sense of what, I had to teach my parents what it was I was doing and what the business was about.
Do you think that resistance actually helped you out a little bit?
It did, because it made me very thorough about what I was doing. So whenever I wanted my dad to like send me to a summer theater, right? I would like make a list of, like, it's how I convinced them to let me go to Cancun on a senior trip with my friends. Like, my dad is a lawyer, so he likes evidence presented. He likes you to gather the data and show him.
I imagine being this kid.
I
ate all my vegetables.
I was really smart about how I tricked him into thinking that these things were a good idea. And then I got into NYU right after college to the grad acting program at Tisch. And there were, I don't know, like 800 people that auditioned for like 17 spots, and I got one of them. So I think by that point, he thought, well, if he gets an MFA, he can teach if it doesn't work out, you know, or he can teach while he's auditioning.
Your dad was all about having a backup plan.
100%.
And conservative approach.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've had to, I've had this interesting mix of like total Hail Mary passes, you know, risk taking, mixed with a kind of cautious moderation, which has, I think, served me. You know, for me, I think having this, whatever was calling me into this risk taking, you know, moving to California or saying I wanted to be a professional actor in the first place, being a musician now, I've had to train myself how to be much more courageous because it's not in my DNA exactly.
So if this didn't work, it was going to be your dad's worst case scenario.
Yeah, but I also think that there's value in not having a backup plan because I think it's so hard and you want to quit so much that giving yourself no other options can be good, but it can also be a disaster.
Right.
You know, we were talking about Ethan Hawke earlier. I was really inspired. I read this article where his dad was an actuary. He did the exact same thing I did, but the actuary accountant version, and I did the lawyer version.
Where you had to get up on the stand.
Yeah, exactly. But he found that the careers he most admired were the ones who had taken the biggest risks and had gone all in without a backup. And he said to his dad, I am statistically in a better place if I just go all in than if I kind of creep in or put one foot in, one foot out.
Right.
I think there's got to be a book written on maybe I could write it with my dad, but a dialogue between a parent who's terrified about their kid being an artist and the artist child and what that negotiation looks like.
Yeah.
I mean, some people don't have the parents who are present or who care or will even entertain the dialogue. But I think it's an interesting kind of genre of, you know, how do you talk to your parents? And my dad wrote an article, I think, for the American Bar Association magazine about, you know, supporting your artist child or how do you, and he took him through all his fears about it. And
really?
My life looks a lot different than his life. The hardest moment probably was, I was having a hard time getting cast in theater, and I was having a hard time getting cast in film and TV in New York. My girlfriend at the time was working in LA, so I moved out to be with her. I got cast in a pilot for the WB on my very first audition in LA.
Was that Off-Center?
Off-Center.
Okay.
Which I then ended up getting fired from after we shot it, and they picked it up, but they dropped me and replaced me with another guy.
Oh, you're kidding. Okay,
yeah.
So did that feel like your big break when you got that and then...
Kind of. I mean, I started to learn that the way people talk to you in Hollywood is always, they're always puffing you up, you know, like, oh, this show's going to be huge. There's no way this won't get picked up. You're going to be a huge star. The head of Warner Brothers TV said, we're going to turn you into a big TV star or something like, you know, I was 27 maybe. I was in my miserable 20s, yeah. Which I thought this would be my salvation, right?
Right.
Oh, I'm going to be on
I'm going to get this and yeah. I won't be miserable anymore.
And I didn't have any money and I got a decent amount of money for the pilot. And I got replaced. And I remember, you know, the call to my parents to tell them that this happened. But it ended up to be, my dad now calls the firing my big break because he insists that it did, I had to locate some kind of grit. You know, it's that which doesn't kill you, right?
Sure.
So
yeah.
When I got fired, I went back east and I did two plays that I had lined up. And I had to decide if I was going to go back to LA or if I was just like, well, did Los Angeles reject me? Did all of television reject me?
So what was your kind of self-messaging after getting fired from that?
I had some interesting things happen. One of which, the head of my agency at the time called me and just launched into a list of famous people who had been replaced on pilots. And it was a long list of really impressive people.
Right.
You know, there's some quote about a writer who says, pay attention to what early critics hate about your writing, because it might be the most interesting thing about your writing.
Oh, really?
And I thought, well, maybe I got fired for a good reason, in that maybe I just didn't blend in. But also, the show wasn't great. And I ended up feeling like, I don't know if I would want to be on that show anyway. Now, and then about 6-8 months later, I got cast on this John Wells show called The Court with Sally Field and all these great people. So I was suddenly on this prestigious hour-long drama, which was canceled after 3 episodes because no one watched it, but we shot 6.
But it was prestigious.
It was prestigious. And I, of course, was like, well, I'm not a sitcom actor. I'm an hour-long.
Clearly, that was the
that
problem.
That was it. I will never do a sitcom. Never. You hear that, universe? And and then 2 weeks after The Court got canceled, I got cast opposite Kathleen Turner in The Graduate on Broadway. So my very worst year was followed by my very best year. So it was a really quick lesson in, you know, the rug can be pulled out from under you and you can bounce back really quickly.
Right.
So by the time I had done The Court and I had done The Graduate, I really felt like I had some wind at my sails and something had shifted. I tell people the things that you think are victories in this business, like you have to broaden your definition of what a victory is. Like if you're a young actor and you go in, if a casting director sees you more than once, that means they like you. Call that a victory. They keep seeing you. If they tell you, great audition, you're not right for this role, that's a victory. If you get a call back, you know, you meet the producer and the director, but you don't get the role, that's a victory. It's not all about getting the role or, you have to learn how to celebrate. Because the other thing about this business I find is the carrot keeps moving. So if I'm on a pilot, I think, oh, that's great. No, now it has to get picked up to series. Oh, now it has to not get canceled. Now it has to turn into a global phenomenon. Oh, now I'm a TV actor, I gotta be a film actor or I'm worthless. Like whatever, you know, whatever your head is doing to try to keep you dissatisfied. It's like rigged for dissatisfaction. So I found I had to find some sort of motor or fuel or satisfaction that had nothing to do with the latest thing, because it's exhausting. That chase is exhausting.
Yeah. If you don't have some sort of philosophy or self-governing about the business, it can eat you up.
100%. That's a great, you need a guiding philosophy. I love that kind of self-governance. Like I learned very early on, I got out of school with all the like Yale, Juilliard, NYU people all at the same time. So there's this influx of people. And it was our first time, and some of us had agents, some of us didn't. And I found that sitting around with young actors talking about unemployment, talking about why is so-and-so getting so-and-so and not me or you, I found that to be like a pretty toxic environment. And I thought, this is not going to help me to sit around and talk about, because it's also, it's got that kind of gossip energy, which is seductive. And it's really hard because I was also unemployed quite a bit. It wasn't like I was working all the time. I found when I was, my first couple years out of school, the roles that I booked were when I went into the waiting room and either I was the only person in the waiting room or I was the only guy in the waiting room. The second another guy walked in and signed in and I saw he was auditioning for my part, I would compare myself, I would debase myself. I'd be like, oh, we're supposed to wear a jacket and tie, I'm not going to get this role. Or whatever. I was so easily knocked off my piece by the presence of another person. And the other thing that I really loathed about being a young actor, the dispiriting kind of energy of sitting in a room with like 10 guys who look vaguely like you.
Yeah.
I never liked that feeling of being just a dude, like just a dude who was trying to do this with a lot of other dudes.
Right. You don't want to look too far into the business and go, okay, let me run the numbers.
Don't
How many
run
guys
the numbers.
Like me?
Do not run the numbers.
They came out of a prestigious
My dad
school.
Ran the numbers, and that's why he was freaked out, because he looked at unemployment rates and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But I think those rates are a little fishy, because like if a guy who's never had an acting job, he can say he's an actor.
Right.
Right.
He
has his SAG card from something, but he's never worked, and then he's a part of the unemployment.
So your dad's calling you going, there are 16,000 27-year-old SAG-holding white men.
Yeah. Well, how are you
right now within
yourself?
A one-block area?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But I was the same way. There's something psychologically about, I don't want to know who's doing what and who's my competition. Like, I don't even ask, like, who else is up for the role, really.
Well, it's so interesting hearing sort of your upbringing, how you're in this show now where there's a bunch of kids going through all of that.
I know.
You got kids that are, what, 20, 21 years old on the
show?
Yeah,
I mean, Ellie is 17, and, like, you know, yeah, I have, yeah, there's young kids all around.
What does that do for your acting to sort of see where those kids are? I mean, is there an energy from that that you get rather than working with a bunch of jaded 40-year-olds?
Yeah. I mean, well, there's a couple things. One is, I have such sharp memories of being like a 16, 17, 18-year-old kid who wanted to do this.
You do.
He lives in me. Like, I do, I'm not cynical. I remember I was walking I did some press in New York last week for Rise, and I got off the plane, and I was walking to baggage claim at Kennedy, and I realized that I was coming to New York to promote this show for NBC that I'm the lead of. And I don't know, I just hovered above myself, and the 16-year-old in me was so excited. There was nothing, I wasn't over it. The other thing that's kind of interesting about Rise is I am the product of a public school drama department in the Midwest. And there's a kind of meta thing going on with Rise, which is I'm playing Lou, and Lou is trying to bring the best out of these kids, and he's trying to, you know, direct them and mold them and help them grow and shine.
Yeah.
But also, I have more experience than these kids. Like for some reason, I didn't realize until I showed up, and I realized, oh, these kids grew up watching How I Met Your Mother. Like, I am the veteran here. You know, I was Mr.
Totally.
Radner in a
yeah.
way, you know? And
you weren't J-Rads.
No, not now I am. They don't respect me at all, those bastards. No, I'm kidding. But, you know, and I realized it was important for me to model a certain kind of behavior. If you stay in the business, you become, at some point, you become a veteran, or you just get more miles in the saddle.
Yeah.
And you know what the drill is.
Okay, so one of the things about this show that makes it unique is there's a show within a show. There's a play that you're producing within the arc of the series, and it's this play called Spring Awakening. And we get to watch your character's personal struggles. The kids are against the idea originally. The school board's against the idea. The town is against the idea. And there's this thing hanging over the whole series of there could be a very public failure.
Yeah.
It just made me think about when you become famous, when there are stakes that are real.
Yeah.
There's opportunities for failures on a much grander scale, public
yes,
failures.
Yes, 100%.
And I wonder how, like, if you related to that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there's certain role. I played this morphine-addicted surgeon in the Civil War in the show called
Mercy Street.
Yeah. Yeah. I did a ton of research because I was like, this is a whole other thing I got to step into. Lou, I know what it's like to be in the Midwest. I know what high schools are like. I know what drama departments are like. I know what it's like to be 43. I think we're around the same age, me and the character, right? So there were so many parallels emotionally and psychologically of what was going on with him, you know, not wanting to repeat certain things he had done, trying to step into something new, trying to take these risks, and the attendant fear of failure, that the possibility of failure that comes
right.
along with that. I think it was around the seventh episode, I had like a little panic attack. It was in the middle, I don't know if it was in the middle of the night or before I'd gone to bed, or I was trying to learn lines, and I was convinced that I had blown it. Like I was blowing it, like I was not good at
like
this.
In general?
Just generally, like I was being a bad actor and Lou was not coming through, or I was playing him wrong, or I had a wrong take on him, just something. And then it occurred to me that the episode we were working on was where Lou loses total faith in himself. And I realized that I was so dropped into the character that I was having a parallel experience as an actor. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like the very feeling was proving that you were doing it
yes,
right.
Yes, exactly. And I talked to someone, they said, well, do you see what a great sign this is? Like how dropped in you are to the character that if you really take on, I used to think that, no, I'm an actor. I leave it at the office, I go home, right? But the older I'm getting, I see that the characters that you end up playing are the characters that only you could play. But like, oh, that's why I had to play that part, or that's why I got that part.
Yeah.
I needed to explore something. I needed to look at some demons. I needed to shed some old stuff. And then, but with this one, I 100% related to his yearning to break out of something, a rut. And also his fear that he would crash and burn.
Yeah.
You know? And that's also how you know you're in a well-written thing.
Because everything fits.
Everything is usable. Like, everything goes into it.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I wondered if there was, you know, after you sign on for this, because you did 9 years on How I Met Your Mother.
Yeah.
Now you come back to network television again. And I guess I was curious about if it brought up any sort of fears about, I'm putting myself back in this situation where I have no control over how long this job goes. Or
yeah. I try to just really be with a decision and see how it feels in my body. I was offered something a year ago.
Black Panther.
I was offered Black Panther, and I just didn't think I was. Yeah. It was a pilot, and it was a charming script, and they really wanted me to do it. And the producer was like, you know, the heads of the studio network were calling me personally to ask me to do it.
A gold Mercedes.
I just
left in your driveway.
I noticed that when I'm confused and when I literally have to like write out why this might be good or not good, like, or I have to send the script to a lot of people and be like, what should I do? I find that confusion is a tell for me that it's probably not good for me. And my friend John read the script, who's not in the business but is a trusted kind of friend, and he read it and he said, I don't think this is going to light you up. I don't think your feet are going to hit the ground excited about this in the morning. When he said that, like, my shoulders dropped. I felt like I could breathe again, and I was like, oh, I'm not doing it.
You've got permission to.
I'm not doing it, right?
Yeah.
So I passed. And then a week later, I got an email that Kadams wanted to meet about Rise. And I just thought, oh, geez. And then I had a meeting with Jason, which was so easy, and it felt like we were long-lost pals.
You know?
So it's just my body said yes to it. My non-intellectual mind, the part of the gut, right? It just says, do this. But I do so many things now, and I'd say like more than half my work life is self-generated. So I have that. I think when I started out working, acting was everything for me.
Right.
And it was unhealthy because it was too, I needed permission to do it, and it was, some days it was, you know, feast or famine. And now I just grip it a little less tight, you know? I think of acting a little bit as my day job. I mean, music is my real obsession these days.
And, right, right.
And I'm writing a book. I just have enough things that if this show doesn't work out, and I really hope it works out because I think it's terrific, but it's not my everything.
Right.
And I've gotten much better at knowing what I can control and what I can't control.
I imagine that when fame did hit for you, it hit in a very specific and intrusive way because of the nature of sitcom television. All of a sudden, everything's being scrutinized and you're losing your identity or you're losing control. And I mean, it's kind of a crazy gauntlet that you went through on that show to get to this point where you can say that. I mean, was there a point in your life when it was not clear that you were going to figure these things out?
You know, they don't teach you in drama school how to deal with sudden fame or visibility.
Right.
No one teaches you that.
They don't set up a fake grocery store and have you walk through.
And it's also like you have to be careful who you talk to about it because it can sound grotesque. You know, if you say like, I'm really unhappy because I'm on this huge sitcom.
Were you really unhappy for
the
a
first
while?
Couple years? I was.
You were.
Well, I don't know if I knew how unhappy I was until I was out of the unhappiness. You know. And I had some indelicate moments. I had some moments where friends were like, knock it off. You know, I wasn't a monster, but you can be tone deaf or blind to certain things that you don't realize how that sounds, right?
And you're young and
yeah.
It's happening
so
for the
I
first
found
time.
The great gift of it was after the second year, I was drinking a lot. I was just checked out. I felt like guilty that I wasn't enjoying it more. And I think I felt, I started to feel that the character was someone who I understood exactly how to play, and there were parts of me that were in him, but he felt like such a small part of me that was then so amplified. So,
right.
So I then, people thought I was that guy, and I look like that guy, and I sound like that guy, because I wasn't doing a lot of, you know, character work.
Right.
I was just trying to be relaxed. So I went through a kind of identity crisis that I feel like I've unpacked a lot of, but it's this weird thing, you know, a friend of mine says it's like that I have this avatar with my face out there that's gone and done all these things that I didn't really do,
right.
But people kind of think you are that guy or you did that. So there's a feeling of how, you know, people don't want you to be anything but that guy because they love the thing so much that they need you frozen as that. And I had to really learn what they were saying when they said that and also ignore it completely.
God, I would think the hardest thing would be the realization that it's never going to go back to how it was.
Yeah.
Because I would assume that when fame first starts happening, it's like, oh, this is a fun ride. But then
it's fun and it's also not fun. I think Steve Martin said it's great when you want it and it's terrible when you don't.
Right.
And you wish you had a knob that you could kind
of
turn on.
Well, that would be the thing, I think, that would be the hardest, when you find out that you have no control over the switch.
And I would like to say that sometimes my life is incredibly weird and I get vertigo from it. And other times, no one bothers me and no one talks to me. So I found that the great gift of my discontent with it was that it punctured the illusion that success or fame or a hit show would save my life. And it actually made me get very serious about what matters. Like, I had to ask myself those deep questions. If this isn't going to bring me the kind of sustained joy that our culture tells us for sure it will, what will?
Right.
So then I had to examine my relationship to alcohol because I was using that to kind of numb myself. And I had to ask myself some serious questions about who I was and who I wanted to be in the world and how to navigate this without going insane. Because, look, if fame and visibility in show business saved your life, you wouldn't hear about all the addiction.
Right.
You wouldn't hear about suicide attempts. You wouldn't hear about all the craziness that happens. Clearly, it's a strange kind of petri dish to be in that not everyone survives. So it became, I took it very seriously, like, how do I do this with some grace? That's where you start looking to those people that you think, how are you doing this so well? Like, what's your secret? What have you learned? I was always very curious about that from people.
Well, I assumed that, at about 3-4 years into How I Met Your Mother, you started writing probably Happy Thank You More.
I wrote it my first 2 years on the show.
Okay, so I would think that making those films would be a way to sort of course correct.
Yeah, but the interesting thing was I was on a CBS show produced by 20th Century Fox, which are like these massive conglomerate, you know, corporations. But then I made this indie film for not a lot of money.
Right.
It went to Sundance, won the Audience Award, but I became like a bit of a DIY indie artist while I was on this show for so many years. And now I'm making music and Ben and I self-released. It's like I appreciate the umbrella of the, you know, the corporate parent who can keep the lights on. But at the same time, I feel like the best thing about How I Met Your Mother and the TV work I do is it allows me to make things. It's like it allows me to be a creative person. Like, I can wake up in the morning and I have a bunch of things that I can do that no one is having to give me permission to do.
Right.
And whether they make money or not is not the thing. I just put them in the world and they kind of do what they're going to do. I mean, both my films did not light up the box office, but a lot of people have seen Liberal Arts and Happy Thank You More, Please. I've had some incredibly touching experiences with people who were really affected by those films. So, you know, I want Rise to be a huge hit, sure. I'd love to do it for a couple years because I love the story, I love the people, I love what it's saying. But at the same time, I want to believe in everything I put out there.
Sure,
you know?
Yeah.
And I do find that there's a massive TV audience that might know me and like me or hate me, it doesn't matter, ultimately. But there's a core audience that will go with me wherever I go. You know, they'll listen to my music, they'll go to the films, they'll buy the book, they'll do those things. And it's interesting, I try not to do too much like hovering above myself and calling what I'm doing anything. But I do find that I've always been much more attracted to indie films, obscure singer-songwriters, like we were talking about, you know. Like, I'm always interested in, like, who on the fringes is doing something really interesting. But I also was at the center of this very popular hit show, and I've always been like, why was that show so popular? I mean, I have my theories, but I think if people say, like, why aren't you doing another whatever?
Or, right.
Where have you been? You know, and it's like, I've been on Broadway. I started a band. I'm, you know, writing stuff and loving it. So I don't have that thing that needs to be seen all the time.
Yeah.
But there's an ego part of me that's like that Hollywood ego. Like, you better find your next thing. You better do it. I really have to quiet those voices and just trust the right job is going to come at the right time. I also don't think after being on a hit show for that long, I don't think it's a bad idea to go away for a while.
Right.
You know,
right.
Like, I went to New York and did two plays and and just started playing guitar. And I'm like, songwriting's given me the greatest joy of my life right now. So I just feel like if How I Met Your Mother earned me anything, it's the right to be creatively fulfilled.
Is interesting to have that dichotomy between having massive success on a mainstream level and having the heart and soul of somebody who's, you know, likes obscure singer-songwriters and weird art and weird plays or whatever.
Yeah.
Because you can't talk about how success is in any way. Like, it's very hard to talk about the detriments of success.
I think it's an absolutely essential and underreported phenomenon. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you ask someone, you know, did success solve all your problems? Did money solve all your problems? Like, most of them would be like, nah.
Yeah.
Or it brought on a whole lot of other problems.
But with you, it also maybe put this discovery of guitar or a chance to make three albums. It put everything on hold because, of course, you can't turn your back on that while it's happening. And I think you describe starting this band as a course correction. Like, it would be interesting to wonder what your path would have been like if How I Met Your Mother went one season.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. Well, I've sometimes thought about that. Like, if I just showed up at Sundance with Happy Thank You More Please and no one knew me, I think they'd be like, cool film.
The lead of every story wouldn't be,
How I Met Your Mother star. Or, you know, this really pissed me off, but when we won the Audience Award, the New York Times reported it as the sitcom-style comedy. And I was like, screw you. That's not a sitcom. There's nothing about it that's like a sitcom. You know, there's no world in which How I Met Your Mother doesn't factor in mightily to what I do for the rest of my life. In that, every move is on some level a response to it. So, for instance, when the show was done, if I got offered, you know, single guy in the city looking for love, like, I wouldn't do that. It's like I thoroughly explored it. No need to do that.
Right.
But when Civil War Surgeon comes along, I'm like, yeah, I want to do that. Or I guess my GPS is not so much, oh, I gotta, because if I think too much about what other people are thinking about me, it's very paralyzing. And you can't help but do some of it because you do, you know, you want people to like what you do, or sure, you want to be believable and all this stuff. But the truer part of me that I really try to tap into, much like with the pilot I was offered before Rise, is, you know, where's the joy live? I had a meditation teacher years ago who said, follow the charm. You know, like, what is charming to you? And I really like that term because it's not like follow your bliss, which can get a little, you know, woo-woo. It's like, what is charming to you? It's a very subtle thing. Like, oh, I kind of, you know, I want a donut now. I'm going to go. And you meet someone at the donut shop and you take a walk and it leads you, you know, and you see that for sale sign and
you're 350 pounds.
Yeah, exactly. that slowing metabolism. But I didn't start writing music with Ben to stop being the guy from How I Met Your Mother. I started writing music with Ben because it was giving me so much joy and we were having so much fun doing it.
I think it's a courageous thing to say, okay, I'm going to take steps backward to become good at another medium.
Well, that's exactly what Lou does. 17 years as an English teacher. I feel like any, certainly a creative life that is robust and sustainable involves massive amounts of risk and like course correction, like taking unexpected routes and not hitting the same notes that you've always hit. So you have to freak yourself out a good bit. And that's hard because the mind wants to cling to what it knows.
Yes, and as we get older and more comfortable.
As you get older, you're rewarded for what you...
Or we have things, or we have dependents.
Yeah. Exactly. Like, why would you not do that? Like, we had a show last night at Hotel Cafe, Radner and Lee, and I said... that I started playing guitar at 42. And I said, I feel like a walking, you know, poster person. I can't say poster boy because I'm not, but the whole point is I'm not for people who wanted to do that thing for so long but think they're too old to do it.
Yeah.
You know, you can do it. You just have to put in your time. The truth is what we really long for is like a really hard problem to solve. We want to solve it, but we want to work on the problem. And this is something I found Ben and I always talk about at our shows. We say, by the way, mistakes are allowed at Radner and Lee shows. Like, we love it, so enjoy it when it happens. And it takes the pressure off us to be perfect. The audience can relax, because I think what people really want to see is someone struggling to make something, not the perfect presentation. I heard this thing years ago. I don't remember where I heard this, but there was a guy, it was like a parlor trick, where he could throw a pool ball and catch it on top of the stick.
Oh.
Right?
On the cue.
Yeah, on the cue. And he could do it over and over, and he would just do it. But no one was all that impressed, and someone said, why does no one care that I can do this? He said, you have to miss the first two.
Right.
Catch the third one.
Right.
Right? Because we want to see the progress. And
yeah.
So I found that making films and writing songs and learning how to play guitar, they're just fantastic creative problems. One of the most underused phrases is, I don't know. I mean, what if a politician said that in a debate? Like, I don't know. I would probably vote for them, you know? But if I wrote a story and it was just this person was born and they had a really happy childhood and then everything worked out and it was all great, that's a terrible story.
Sure.
Like,
yeah.
What we want in stories, we want obstacle, we want challenge, we want someone to feel like they're going to fail, we want them to triumph over the odds and adversity. We want all those things. So why in our own lives do we think our lives should be devoid of those very elements that make a story great?
Yeah.
And I find that the more risk I take, the more I step into that kind of unknown place, the more satisfying my life is, because it feels like it has meaning.
Yeah. At this age and with successes in other fields, you know, in your past, what do you get from sitting down and having to learn something that there's no getting around the practice and the hours of something like that? It's not something you can fake it till you make it.
Right.
Right? What do you get out of that discipline?
I've been such an obsessive music lover for so long that I didn't realize that I didn't only want to look adoringly at a band or a songwriter, I actually wanted to be up there. And that to discover that I had some facility for it, and that the more chords I learn and the better I get at arranging them and playing them, that I can be making that thing that I love so much, I can't tell you the joy it's bringing me. You know, it feels to me like when Ben and I are writing together, or I'm writing a song, and I don't have anywhere else to be or anything else to do but write a song, it just feels like success to me. Like, I earned that.
Do you ever feel like I have to prove that I'm worthy of being here, because otherwise it's going to be my vanity project?
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely played the, you know, actors with side music projects is a subgenre with great shame, writing songs.
I guess I was curious if it messed with your joy at all, if you had to stop and talk yourself back and go, I'm doing this.
You know, the first couple times we performed live, I had this feeling of like, what am I doing? Like, this is ridiculous. And like, are they here because I was on TV? Like, the whole thing I was confused about. But for some reason, I have decided that I'm going to be playing guitar the rest of my life, and I'm going to be writing songs for the rest of my life. There's no question. It's something that is, it just resonates in such a way that, I'm just going to keep doing it.
Right. You know? I was curious what the difference is between playing a character where there's writing in between you and the character you're playing versus getting up there in front of an audience and singing words that you wrote that are in some cases clearly very autobiographical.
Yeah.
If that feels more vulnerable to you or a different kind of art.
You know, it's strange. When you're playing a character, there's a certain amount of armor on you.
Yeah.
And that you didn't write the part, and you're honoring someone else's vision more than your own, probably, even though you're affecting it greatly with your interpretation. Certainly, writing songs and playing music is a pretty vulnerable thing. But I find that in a weird way, I feel more comfortable. Like, I can assure you that I will be more comfortable in this conversation than like the photo shoot we're going to do after this.
Right.
Just because I feel...
You get to take control of the narrative here.
Yeah.
Right? Is that what you mean? Like,
well,
versus...
I get to just listen and respond. which I'm pretty comfortable doing. So I feel like I'm less self-conscious. I lose myself a little bit in when I'm just listening and talking.
Right.
Whereas, you know, if, you know, a photo, it's like, you know, like I feel frozen or I feel reduced to the physical, which always bothers me.
Which you talk about also when you lose an identity or someone decides who you are and it's a smaller version.
Yeah, yeah. That's one of the things, maybe I've diversified my career in the way that I have. This would be unconscious, but maybe part of the fuel of it is you won't be able to pin me down as something. You know, I would say in some ways, the more authentic I feel like the thing is I'm offering, the less sensitive I am around it not being received in a certain way, just because I believe in it more. But at the same time, I know that there are people that just are going to be allergic to me, whatever I do, and it doesn't matter. But I also, like, if I got to look at, you know, what movies and TV they watch, I'd be like, oh, that's not the kind of stuff I make.
Right.
That's why they don't like me.
Maybe the best prerequisite for being in a band and getting up on stage is to have 9 years of a super successful TV show where you've got every kind of comment thrown your way.
Yeah.
You're bulletproof.
Well,
at this point.
I've always, it's a demon of, you know, being overly sensitive to the opinion of other people. I think a lot of artists have it. And to develop that shell that can inoculate you against, you know, that stuff taking you down, while at the same time maintaining the kind of sensitivity and openness that you need to make good stuff, that's a real interesting balancing act. And it's something that a lot of people, you got to do that again if you're going to sustain the career, because things come flying at you in this day and age, you know, with the social media and the, and I've kept myself largely from that. I don't read reviews. You know, there's the other thing is 100 people love you, one doesn't, and you obsess over the one.
Right. That's the person. I
have a friend, an actress, who said, I've read all my reviews. I cannot remember a single good review, but I can quote the bad reviews verbatim. I know I could say them back to you right now. There's something about our brain. They've done studies on this. Negative comments are like Velcro in our brain. They just stick to you. And positive ones, we need like...
They're like covered in butter.
They slide right away. Out. We need to sit with them a little bit longer and really take them in and metabolize them. I don't know what that is. But I think there's a tendency to believe the worst about ourselves, which is unfortunate, you know. I'm always trying to re-educate myself in that without tipping into grandiosity or something, you know.
Yeah, but I have to say, I think that the way you are handling your career and the choices you're making, it's commendable, because I think that, you know, there's a lot of people who would get to your place of fame and need to keep it there. So mm-hmm. It looks like you've not only looked under the hood of that theory, but also that you haven't lost your way in terms of the things that made you happy from the beginning. And
and
I think that makes you a really interesting artist.
I so appreciate that. And I found it was really healthy for me to get the things early that I was told would make me happy, find out they didn't, so I could get into what really did.
Yeah.
And my life in some ways is a response to having punctured the illusion. Now, I still think like, well, I guess How I Met Your Mother didn't give me everything I want, but maybe an Oscar would. Like you could still, that's still at work in your consciousness, that thing. But I also know Oscar winners who are miserable. So it doesn't solve anything.
So, like you said, it's the next thing.
Always the next thing.
Yeah.
Will I win another Oscar? Will I be a movie star? It's endless. So I sometimes think about like in school when I had like a creative project to do with a friend, I was like in heaven. Like I loved those things, you know, making things and presenting them to the class. And I'm still on some level doing that. It was like I even had a sense back then, this is what I really love doing. I love being creative. And the more I do it and the deeper I go into it, I feel less like a fraud and more like a person who's actually doing what he's supposed to be doing in the world.
Well, it's funny. I watch my daughters, and my older daughter loves to make things, and she gets this kit once a month called the Maker's Kit in the mail. And this last one was like a series of syringes that were filled with water that led to tubes that controlled a crane, and took her 4 or 5 hours to make it, and completely absorbed, didn't want to come out of her room, wasn't hungry. She finished it. She played with it for about 20 minutes. It's been on the shelf ever since.
Yeah.
And you can learn so much from that. As a child, it's the joy of the problem solving, yeah. of the making. Once it's done, that's such a great metaphor for like an award on a shelf.
Yeah.
Like, we have no use for that.
Yeah.
It was the process. It was the challenge. It was the problem solving. That's where the joy is.
Yeah, to lose yourself in, you know, to get into what they call flow.
Yeah.
Where time is gone. The world is it's just what you're doing. And then there's something deeply satisfying in this moment about songwriting, because I can spend an afternoon writing a song and I can play it for you. And I say, I made this thing. You know, a movie is 2 years
right.
before you can say, look, I made this thing.
Well, listen, it's been fascinating just getting to know you a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, it's so good to talk to you.
Yeah,
thanks for having me.
And thanks for digging into this stuff a little bit, because it's not the easiest thing to talk about, you know, to really explore why we make art, or why art is a sustaining thing, and how success gets into that. And I think you're living this artist life, and you're living the parts of it that are good rather than the parts that are comfortable or ego driven. And that's what I think is fascinating.
It's a tightrope, you know, it's a balancing act
yeah.
because there's things that pull at you from all sides, both externally and internally. And if I can just remind myself, you know, of a lot of what we were talking about, you know, like where the joy is. And
yeah.
I always think about something from the Bhagavad Gita that talks about what Krishna says to Arjuna, you know, do the work, do the work, do the work. The fruits of the labor are not yours.
Well, you are doing
the work. Cool.
And I appreciate you coming in.
Yeah.
Thanks
so much for having me.
Hey folks, that's our show. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did, and make sure you check out Josh's new show, Rise, on NBC. It's made by Jason Kadams, who also helmed Friday Night Lights and Parenthood. If you know those shows, you know that Rise has a pedigree and a style to storytelling that is great television, so check that out. And also, you can see the two films Josh wrote, directed, and starred in, Happy Thank You More Please and Liberal Arts. And, of course, there are those 9 seasons of How I Met Your Mother that you can dive right into if you're the one person that never saw that show. So, I want to thank you all for tuning in each week. And as you know, we've been doing this show for a while now. And we are a podcast, but we are also a television show. And you can see that show on DirecTV's Audience Network on Channel 239. And if you don't have DirecTV, well, don't despair, because you can go straight to our website, offcamera.com, and subscribe to our monthly subscription. For just $4.99 a month, you can have access to every show we've ever done to watch anytime on any device. That's right, for only $4.99 a month, you can have over 150 hours of conversation and wisdom from the most iconic artists of our time. It's a great way to get connected with the show and to also support the show. And in my opinion, as lovely as the podcast is, and God knows I love podcasts and being able to go on road trips and listen, there's also a great experience waiting for you when you watch the show. You can see these thoughts form on these artists' faces as they describe their creative path, their struggles, and their process. And in my opinion, it's quite a fascinating thing to see. So please, if you haven't checked out the TV show yet, try it out and then send me an email. Tell me what you think. I'm Sam at offcamera.com. You can also find us on social media. We are Off Camera Show at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And I am Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. And if you follow me on Instagram, you're going to end up seeing a lot of behind the scenes and exclusive photography from the show. So check all that out. And please tell your friends about the show. We want to keep growing this thing so we can keep bringing you these conversations. All right, that's my pitch for today. I want to thank everybody that works on the show, and then I want to tell you about next week's guest. First off, our producer, Crawford Shippey, our editor, Nathan Shields, our visual artist, Michaela Galvin, our office manager, Sasha Snow, our transcriptionist, Kara Johnson, and Matt Davidson, who is on leave this week while he clears up some legal matters involving a ferret. We couldn't put on a show without the talents and hard work of all these people, so thank you. And be sure to join me next time when I sit down with actress and singer Christina Hendricks.
I could have just been a kid who went to ballet class and went home, but there must be some weird thing inside me that I couldn't just be a little girl dancing. I had to get so passionate about it that the bleeding toes and the taping of the feet and the struggle became very romantic to me. Like, I wanted to be a suffering artist when I was like 9. There was something about reaching beauty that swept me off my feet.
Of course, my mother only knows her as Joan from her favorite television show of all time, Mad Men. But she is oh so much more. But when you're at the center of a cultural television phenomenon, people often confuse you with your character. Since Mad Men, she has been able to explore diverse experiences from Sondheim to edgy indies like Ginger and Rosa, and is now embracing a new role as a stay-at-home mom turned criminal counterfeiter in her new show, Good Girls, what she aptly describes as pioneering network television. And as I found out, her path to success was both unconventional and perilous, and according to her father, still in question. See you next time, off camera.